We've been spending some time looking at the Kings, and we will endeavor to move forward tonight. Last week, we concluded a discussion of the life of King Jehoshaphat, and we looked at, a couple weeks ago, we looked at some struggles that he went through, and then last week, we focused on the triumphs of his life. And so, you had, of course, Jehoshaphat in the south. While he was king, you had a succession of kings in the north. Of course, at the beginning of his reign was Ahab. And, of course, Ahab's reign in Israel was not necessarily a righteous one. He definitely made some bad choices along with his wife Jezebel. And so in this study, we'll go back to the north for a moment and look at the transition from Ahab to a very short reign of his son, Hazael. And again, what got in his way. And then I want to come and focus on a transition from Elijah to Elisha and some things that go along with that. Eventually, I don't know if we'll get there tonight, but eventually we'll get into talking about Joram in Israel and Jehoram in Judah and kind of what was going on there as we move forward with the kings. But just as a way of reminder, of course, we passed out this early on, but this is kind of a reminder list of the kings. Looked at the three kings up here, Saul, David, and Solomon, and we moved into the divided period and went pretty good distance here as well. So we'll continue to cover these, but as we know, Jehoshaphat was a good king, like his father Asa, but in the north, it's a different story. And so as we move down now to Hazael, things continue to not go so well for the north. But there's also something interesting with all of this. Of course, in the south, all of the kings in the south all come from whom? I feel like this thing's picking up extra well tonight. Sorry. All from David, right? They're all in the line of David. And you can see that in the chart here. I know it's hard to see. But you have to trust me for now. I'll give this to you later. Over here, of course, you've got the United Kingdom. And then you come down to the division between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And then you begin. So over here on the right side, your right side, is the line of the kings of Judah. And you see there's almost a straight line down all the way to the time of Babylonian captivity. However, over here, in regard to Israel, you keep having these parallel movements. Well, what that chart's trying to show you is that at these times, God is removing the kingdom from the father, and he's giving it to someone else. And so you see that, like Jeroboam, the kingdom was taken away from him, given to Baasha. That kingdom was taken away from him, given to Omri. And this kind of continues on down. The kingdom will be taken away from Ahab eventually, and it'll be given to Jehoram over here. And again, he'll lose the kingdom. And we'll continue to see this problem pop its head up. God is having to take the kingdom away from certain individuals because of their sin. And that definitely is pretty paramount in the north.
I'm laying that up pretty much. Y'all see what I'm trying to say?
Hopefully I can show you. That's not as clear as mud. So let's go into 1 Kings 22. 1 Kings 22, of course, we find out that Ahab, earlier in this chapter, has died in battle. And if you go down to verse 51, read those last three verses there, the text tells us that Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria. Now, Samaria is significant because of why? It's the capital of the north, right? So that's where they reigned from in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat. So to give yourself a kind of put yourself on the timeline here, Jehoshaphat has been king in the south for 17 years at this point when Ahaziah comes to reign over the north. And he reigned reigned 2 years over Israel. So a very short reign. And then it gives this commentary on him in verse 52. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in the way of his mother. Of course, why include his mother there? His mother was Jezebel. So she kind of stands out as far as queens do in the book of Kings because of how evil she was. And he goes on, he says, and in the way of Jeroboam, you see how that tie goes back all the way back to Jeroboam and what Jeroboam did, who made Israel to sin. And then he gives us some details. He said he served Baal and worshipped him. Now, not only did he allow the people to do that, but what's the text indicate? He did it himself. One of the difference between Jehoshaphat and Ahaziah is what? Well, Jehoshaphat, did he allow some idolatry to go on in the country? Yes. He did. What's the difference then?
He didn't do it.
He didn't participate in it. Now, not justifying him allowing it going on, that was still wrong. But you see that with Ahaziah, it's a degree worse because he actually went and participated in the act itself. Now, he served Baal and worshipped him and provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger in every way that his father had done. And so, not a very good commentary on someone's life. And that's the way 1 Kings ends. So, as you begin 2 Kings, what we'll find out is it picks right back up with Ahaziah and gives us not details really of his life, but of one event in his life. So the sole commentary in regard to his reign in totality is what we find in 1 Kings 22, 52, right, where it says he served the Baals, he did what was evil, 52 and 53. But in 2 Kings chapter 1, it details how his life ended. All right, so let's go over there and look at a few of these verses. We won't read the whole chapter, but I want to note some things. All right, so in verse 2, the text tells us that Ahaziah fell through lattice in his upper chamber in Samaria and lay sick. Now, we don't know what he was doing. Was he up painting the upper eaves and fell off a ladder? Right? How did he get to the lattice work? I don't know, but I know it was a significant fall. How do we know that? It didn't kill him, but it laid him up in his bed sick. So here's the king. He's fallen through this lattice and he's landed, and now he's so sick that he's bedridden. He can't get up, can't move around, maybe broke his back, I don't know what he did. But he's there. Now, what's his response to this? That's the significant part. So go on and read the last part there. He sends messengers telling them to do what? He says, go inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this sickness. You've heard Beelzebub, right? We've heard that name has probably come up when you talk about idolatry and false gods. You talk about people And even at one point, doesn't the Pharisees accuse Jesus of getting his power from Beelzebub? And of course, that was
true.
But in this instance, we do find out that this idol is where
the king of Israel,
God's people, goes to for help. That's a big problem, isn't it? He didn't go to God. He didn't say, go find Elijah or Elisha and tell him to go to God on my behalf. He says, go to the prophets of Beelzebub and ask for Beelzebub's help. Well, what's God's response? We know he ain't going to be happy about it. But if you keep reading, we won't read all of this, but we find out that God
knows what's going on, and so
he sends an angel to Elijah.
And the angel
tells Elijah to go to the king, and he's to say this: Is it because there is no God in Israel that you're going to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Now therefore, thus says the Lord, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. And so Elijah goes to do that. So because he's turned to Beelzebub, God says, okay, I'm going to give you Beelzebub's cure. He doesn't have a cure, does he? And so God is prophesying, you're never going to get up. Okay, so we have that. That could really serve as the summary for the rest of the chapter. But we have an interesting interaction that occurs between Elijah and the soldiers of Ahaziah. And I just thought it was interesting to mention. So the messengers that the king had sent out a return, and he wants to know why, verse 5. And so they say to him, there came a man to meet us. So somewhere, we're not given the details, but Elijah met these messengers. He gave them what God had told him. And so they have now returned to the king. And so they give him, they basically repeat right back what we read earlier in the chapter. And then go down to verses 7 and 8. So
they meet this man.
Now, at first, it doesn't seem like, doesn't seem like they know who he is. And that's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, we just saw some pretty incredible stuff with Elijah back in 1 Kings, right? He did some pretty insignificant things, and it wasn't that long ago, but it seems as though he's been away long enough from the north, or from at least from the circulation of general population, they've forgotten. At least some of them don't recognize him. And so
they come to him,
they give this message, and the king then wants to know who it is. And so they say he wore a garment of hair with a belt of leather about his waist. Now, they don't know who he is, but the king does. What was always Ahab's response to Elijah? Now, he also had this response for Micaiah as well, the prophet. But what was his response? You troubler of Israel.
At one point he says,
he never has anything, well, that's what he says about Micaiah. He says, never has anything good to say about me. He seemed to have the same attitude in regard to Elijah. So it's fun. It's interesting here that as soon as Hosea hears the description, he's like, I know who that is.
That's Elijah the
Tishbite, isn't it?
That scoundrel was back.
And so
I thought it was interesting, just to,
as a way of reminder, in the book of Malachi, I'm going to take a little side route for just a minute, and we'll come right back. In the book of Malachi, We looked at it on Sunday, didn't we? The very end of the book of Malachi ends with, so there's a lot about Malachi that's very negative toward Israel, or Judah. And for the Israelites, God has a lot of condemning messages. But at the end of the book, he delivers some hope, doesn't he? What's the hope at the end of Malachi? Anybody remember chapter 4?
I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. You can turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse.
So God says through Malachi, I'm sending my prophet. And it's interesting, he doesn't just say in general terms, a prophet, or even the prophet, like he did with Moses. You know, when at the end of Moses' life, God said, I'm going to send another prophet like you. But he doesn't name him. Of course, that's Jesus. But here, he names the prophet. He says, I'm going to send Elijah back to you. Now, Elijah would definitely, for the Israelites, denote a certain connotation of how he looked. Right, what do you know about Elijah? Well, he's a man of God. But what specifically is unique about Elijah?
His dress.
His dress.
Sort of rough, if you will.
What's that?
Sort of rough, if you will. Dress.
Yeah. Kind of a wild man. That's kind of the way he lived. He was, you know, he's one of those guys that everybody in town knows and talks about.
But don't talk to.
Because he's a little different, yeah.
Maybe a lot of people don't talk to.
Right. He's different. He's a guy that
could go out and
live on his own for a while. He did that,
didn't he?
Yeah. One time he goes out and lives in a cave and God has an angel to feed him.
He's a different dude. And he
looks differently. And so when God says through Malachi, I'm going to send you Elijah, that would definitely put a picture, an image in people's minds. All right, so you've got, after Malachi, how long do you have without God speaking directly to the people?
400 years. Wasn't it?
Like 400 years.
Yeah.
And then
you can have somebody
pop up on the scene. You go to Matthew. I don't think I have any of this up here. Let me check. We'll go there in a minute. But Matthew chapter 3,
and verse 4.
Somebody read Matthew 3, 4.
John's clothes were made of camel's hair, and he had a leather belt around his waist. His food was locusts and wild honey.
So, in describing John, John's another interesting guy. He's a little different. We can go and we study the Gospels and we get a full picture of John's life. What do we know about John?
What are some
interesting facts about him?
Jesus' cousin.
He what? Jesus' cousin. He's related to Jesus. Mary and Elizabeth were related in some way. Made them related. What else do we know?
He ate wild honey and locusts.
Okay. We get a description of his diet and also the way he's dressed. We also know that Elizabeth was barren, so she was older in years when she had had John, right? But we also know that it wasn't just some birth, right? Now, it's not the Immaculate Reception, that's the Notre Dame talking. Conception, right? It wasn't the Son of God, but that they had been blessed by God to have John. John, we also know that John, even in the womb, was touched by what? He was touched by the Holy Spirit. Right? So, Jesus was a different child in the way he behaved. John was a different child, too. Now, I'm not saying he's perfect.
He might have been a little rascal if they had to wrangle up.
But he grows up. He's we know he's a very courageous man. He's very brave. He's very faithful, even to the point of giving his own life for the cause of God.
They said he was the forerunner of Christ.
Yeah, and so this
is back to where we were. So back in Malachi, he said God said, I'm going to send Elijah.
What would they think?
Well, they think a prophet of God,
but they would probably also think Elijah's a different guy. He dressed differently. He looked differently. Well, what do we see in Matthew 3, 4? And isn't it interesting that it's almost the same language? He wore what? A garment of camel's hair, a leather belt around his waist. And so he had a very distinctive look. We also know about John, where did he like to spend time?
Out
by himself, out in the wilderness.
Now, when we think wilderness,
you might get
a picture of the desert. Don't make that
picture.
It's more of just an area where people are not. So he liked
to be alone. But he did have crowds that would gather around him.
He had
many followers. But he was a different guy.
And I think it's
also interesting to note that later on in the book of Matthew chapter 16, when Jesus asked the apostles, who do people say that I am? What was their response? Matthew 16:13.
Some say John the Baptist,
Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets. But you notice the two they mentioned connected together. John or Elijah.
So
even at that time, there wasn't, within the populace, people didn't really understand John completely.
But he was the one whom Malachi prophesied about. So
I just think it's interesting to make that connection there. How even in the Bible, it gives us those connections between Elijah and John. Now, were they the same person?
No.
But God gives us those connections to make between them so that we know who they are and what their purpose is,
the purpose they've undertaken. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So anyway, any other questions about that? So let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 1. So
Uzziah says,
oh, I know who that is. That's Elijah the Tishbite. So I don't know what his plan was, but he decides, I want him to come to me. And so what does he do?
He goes and sits on top of a hill.
He what?
He goes and sits on top of a hill.
Oh, no, not in this. Oh, Elijah does. But what does Uzziah do?
He sends
this military troop of 50. Now, 50 soldiers to collect one man.
That's kind of significant.
That's a
got scared
one
of
dude.
Him. Got scared of him, I guess.
But that's what he decides to do. And I think, I wonder if it's Uzziah here is trying to push, to show his authority and power. You're not going to say it about me. I'm going to come get you. And so he sends those 50 men out. And they go out there to where he is. They call up to him. How does he respond?
If I'm not.
What happens?
If I'm a prophet, let fire come down from heaven.
And so he asks God to send fire down from heaven. Fire comes from heaven.
Kills all of them.
Yep.
Word get back to the king. How does the king react?
He's
not happy. So he sends another 50. They go out there. They're like, the king wants you. He's like, nope.
I ain't going.
He asks for fire to come down. Fire comes down. Another 50. So now you've got a third one.
Huh?
Then he had trouble getting a third set.
Well, we're going to talk about them. I want you to notice the different approach. So the first two times, So he sends the 50 out. They come to the hill, and they say, O man of God, this is verse 9. O man of God, the king says, come down. Right, that's the first group. And then he sends fire, it consumes them. Verse 11, he sends another 50 out. What do they say? O man of God, this is the king's order. Come down quickly. They're even more insistent. God sends down fire from heaven. Zap, they're gone. And then Isaiah's like, okay. So he gets another commander. This commander is going to react a little differently. So he sends out a third. You ever have a job that you're asked to do that you don't want to do?
Sure.
Please don't send me. Please don't send me. I don't want this. I feel like Moses, you know, God sent Moses to Pharaoh.
Like, I don't want to go.
So this guy, he goes. And so, verse 13, and again, the king sent a captain of a third 50 with his 50. And the third captain of 50, I really want you to know 50.
Yeah.
You grab that number, 50.
This goes with the
went up and came and fell on his knees before Elijah and entreated him, oh man of God, please let my life and the life of these 50 soldiers, 50 servants of yours,
be precious in your sight.
Very different approach, right? Has it been established where the power lies?
Yeah, and this one noted.
Now the king may not understand what's going on. These soldiers have got it.
Yeah, they figured it out.
The king trying to throw around his
way. It ain't going to be thrown around on God's man. But this time, God lets Elijah know that he's going to be okay to go along with them.
They showed some what?
Humility. They showed some humility before the man of God. Now, it's not that they should give umbrage or humility to Elijah, but to whom?
To God.
To God.
It's not, they're not really falling on their knees before Elijah. Falling
on their knees before God. And
so God tells him to go. If we
just go on here. So basically God sends them. And verse 15, angel of the Lord said to Elijah, go down with them. Do not be afraid of him. So he arose and went down with him to the king. And he said to him. Now he's already heard this message. So really, there was never a need for Elijah to come. But Elijah tells him the same message. Thus says the Lord, because you have sent messengers to inquire of Beelzebub, the God of Ekron, is it because there is no God in Israel to inquire of his word? Therefore, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. Now, I don't know what the king wanted out of this. I don't think he got what he wanted. Read the very next verse. So he died. You know, I think about the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16. Right? And you see the picture of Lazarus being a poor beggar at the door of the rich man. The text, if you read it, tells us that there was a day when Elijah died and the angels of the Lord came and carried his body or his spirit to Abraham's bosom. And then the text just simply says, and the rich man died and was buried. Right? There's a real contrast in Luke 16 between those two characters. Well, here you've just got the simple statement of, so he died. Just like God had said. And so as a reminder, you know, God means what he says.
And so
Jehoram became king in his place. And don't confuse, this is where it gets very confusing. Kings with the same name.
This is not
Jehoram that will be king in Judah. This is Jehoram that's king in Israel. There will be another Hosiah who will be king in Judah. So it'll be very easy to get these names confused. But now you've got two Jehorams who will serve very close to one another, but are two different men. So anytime you're studying, make sure you know which one you're talking about. Because even if you read this,
at first it confused me.
But Jehoram became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram. So Jehoram became king in the second year of Jehoram.
Now when I read that, and then
I skipped over that second part, and I said, read the son of Jehoshaphat, and I said, wait, no, the
king in Judah didn't
become king in Israel. And then I had to reread it. I thought, okay.
So I got to make sure I'm making that distinction.
And you'll notice, I think, in the
book of
Chronicles, it spells his name differently. It takes the H out and just Jehoram. Jehoram are the same. So just want to point that out. We'll come back to him later on. He becomes king afterwards. But notice this. Because Hosiah had no son, Jehoram is not what?
He's not married.
He's not the son of Hosiah. So what did God tell Ahab?
As part of his punishment. I'm going to take the kingdom away from you. Just like God had prophesied about and told him, God does that. Hosiah dies. The family of Ahab dies. They no longer have power in Israel. And so you have Jehoram who becomes king in his place. Now, Jehoram, not a great king, but he is a king.
So we'll have more to say about him moving forward.
Any questions about that?
All right,
let's transition for just a few minutes. For 2 Kings is going to give us a little interlude here, and we're going to take it with it.
So, so at this time frame, you
have a lot of prophets,
but two men stand out.
Who are they?
Elijah and Elisha.
Now you also have
Obadiah.
I'm going to forget
others, but you got several others who are prophesying at the same
time. But these two men, from a
scriptural
standpoint, have more written about them in particular, and so
Elijah back in
1 Kings. Had kind of taken Elisha under his wing. Do you remember what happened? There was kind of a significant moment. After
what happened on the mountain, and you remember with the
prophets of Baal and with Elijah, and then afterwards he killed all those prophets,
and then what did he do?
He ran.
He ran from there and went and hid in a
hid in a couple of different places. One time he's under a tree,
and then he goes into a cave, and that's where
the angels feeding him.
And anyway, it's kind of at that moment, it seems like God makes the decision, all right, I'm going to plan for your rest. So Elijah has given so much to God. God begins a long journey, seemingly, for Elijah to his retirement, if you will.
And we'll see that as we move forward. But you remember what happened.
So he's headed, so he went
really far south. I don't have the map up here, but I'd show you if I had it. But he went really far south, and then he started making his way up north. And who does he meet along the way?
Elisha.
What's Elisha doing, by the way? Do you remember? Yeah, he's tilling the ground. He's out there
with some oxen. He's tilling the ground. And what does Elijah do?
Puts his mantle on his shoulders.
He did what?
Puts a mantle on his shoulders, takes his mantle, puts it on Elijah.
Well, what's the mantle?
Basically, you're covering
your
vest, if you will.
Yeah, he
takes that coat or vest off, and he puts it onto Elijah's shoulders. And it's from that point forward that Elisha began to follow
Elijah
as kind of a mentoring program.
And so as we progress,
we get to where he is here. So let's go to,
let's see. I don't know if I have any of this up here. Okay. So
let's go to 2 Kings.
verse 1. Now when the Lord was about to do what? To take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind. This would not, if you're writing a novel, you wouldn't want to write it necessarily this way. But it gives you the punchline at the beginning, right? But it kind of gives us a summary in verse 1 of what's going to happen in a little while as we move forward. But he says he's about to take Elijah up in a whirlwind. So God did God just do that on a spur of a moment decision?
No. God didn't. No,
and that's why I think God had begun this in the cave for Elijah. So Elijah went on their way from Gilgal. Now, I just want to show you this map. They did a lot of traveling. I don't know where this stands, if you can see, but here's where he was in the wilderness. But you can see they do a lot of traveling in this area of the country. And so they're making their way back in that direction as we're reading here. So if you go on down to verse 2, it says, Elijah said to Elisha. Now I'm going to read all this, but I'm going to read the first one and then we'll see how it repeats as we go forward. So Elijah says to Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. So in other words, he's saying, I've got a long journey ahead. So you just stay here. I'm going to go that way. God is driving me that way. Now the indication does not seem to be that Elijah knows what's going to happen to him. But he just knows he's being driven this direction.
He's following God.
And so the text says that, but Elisha said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. You think about Ruth with Naomi, right? Don't you think about that? I'm not going to leave you. I'm here. And so and then you get to verse 3 and you have something that's kind of odd. So the end of verse 2 says, so they went down to Bethel. As the sons of the prophet who were in Bethel came out to Elijah
and said to him, do you know
that today your Lord will take your master from over you? And he said, yes, I know it. Keep quiet. Now, think about what they just said. Now, these young men, whoever they were, these young prophets, they have some window into what God's going to do. And it even seems apparent that Elisha knows something's going to happen. And he knows the full extent of it? I don't know. But he says to them, be quiet. It's almost like a surprise party for somebody. That's kind of why he's finally getting his graduation party.
It says, yes, I know.
Yeah.
So somehow God revealed it to the group of prophets and to him. They knew something.
Something's going to happen.
Yeah. So, and so he says, yes, I know.
But keep quiet. And so they go on. This happens again. He will travel on
to Jericho. And you have almost the same kind of thing happened in verses 4 and 5.
In verse 6,
he says, stay here. The Lord sent me to the Jordan. Again, Elisha says, I will not leave you. And then in verse 7, that's a very interesting journey. There's so much going on here. So they get to the Jordan. And what happens? Well, 50 sons of the prophet also went and stood at some distance. So it's not just Elijah and Elisha,
is it?
No. Now they've kind of got a troop going with them. There's a collection going on here. And so they were both standing by the Jordan. Then Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water. And the water was parted to one side and to the other, till the two men could go over on dry ground.
Just interesting to me. It's the same kind of
Moses' situation, he got a smaller body of water, but it's still...
But the thing is, it was drier land. You know, the riverbed wet.
Yeah, he just
takes that coat off
and just struck the ground.
Yeah, it's dry.
What would you get
for a coat like that, right?
Well, I don't know if I don't want Joshua and the people were going into the promised land, right?
All yeah.
When the ark touched, or the feet of the priest touched the water, it stopped. It dried out almost immediately, apparently, because the people went right behind
it. Yeah, instantly.
Yeah.
So, we'll have to continue the psalm.
This stuff fascinates me.
I hope you get something out of it, too. But I think it's so interesting. And all this, of course, is leading up
to what's going to happen.
Wow,
but you've got all these incidents. Now,
we'll talk
maybe a little bit more about the implication of why all this is recorded. Why record this?
Why
do this in front of these young prophets? What's the message God's trying to send?
All right.
We'll be dismissed for
this week, and then next week we'll pick back up here. Thank you. We'll be dismissed now.